And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest planetary scientist, Dan Derda. Dan, let's talk also, if we can, about the possibilities of life out there coming here. Do you believe in that?
There's certainly nothing physically preventing that. You know, it's very difficult for us to travel through interplanetary space, even interplanetary space, let alone interstellar space. We've got four little spacecraft out there, about twice as far out as the planet Pluto, and it's taken us almost two decades now to do that. And it's going to take tens of thousands of years for those little spacecraft. I'm talking about the Voyager 1 and 2, and Pioneers 10 and 11. But you know, if you're talking about civilizations that are thousands, millions of years more advanced than we are, they're going to be having technologies available to them that we would consider magic.
And let's hope they've mastered how to travel throughout the universe.
Again, they may well have. Things that were science fiction to us, 100 years ago, we're now doing pretty routinely. And, I think it'd be arrogant and silly to think that we've uncovered all of the physical laws that govern everything in the universe. There's still lots to learn, and really advanced technologies, really advanced civilizations will have technologies available to them that we can't even comprehend. We don't know at this point.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Who knows? Maybe they have learned how to travel through wormholes, portals in the universe. Are you a believer?
Absolutely. Those are the kinds of things that we sort of extrapolate from our knowledge. We can kind of imagine things like, we know about, thanks to Einstein, we know about things like curved space-time and, the concepts of wormholes that might allow one to tunnel through space-time so that the shortest distance between point A and point B in the universe is not necessarily what we picture in the three-dimensional world as the line between them. There, ways to, people think about ways to, if you will, almost violate the Einsteinian rule that you can't travel faster than the speed of light. Those are our extrapolations from just, what we know so far. Gosh knows what we're going to know 500 years from now that makes all that seem kind of silly and quaint.
What I find fascinating, you said last hour that there's no doubt that some kind of planetary object, huge, hit planet Earth, and that's what helped to create the moon. Zachariah Sitchin wrote in his first book called The 12th Planet of another major object that hit the planet Earth. And he based all his information on old Sumerian texts. What I find fascinating is if those texts are indeed true, and they say that an object hit the planet, and current-day scientists such as yourself believe that a huge object hit the planet, I wonder how they knew about it.
Well, I assume that their base of sociological knowledge and so on that led to that sort of those sorts of stories are probably rather far divorced from our, what our scientific knowledge that is leading to that. I would consider that perhaps an interesting coincidence of sociology, but I'm not sure what the time scales are that the Sumerians were referring to. I suspect it was probably much shorter, but who knows?
It is funny, though, in a sort of strange way.
Earth-Moon is not the only system that we think in our solar system was formed that way. There is another. People sometimes refer or have referred to the Earth as sort of a double planet because our moon, compared to the size of the Earth, is larger than any other moon in the solar system. It's not true in an absolute sense. There are moons out there that are bigger than the planet Mercury. But in a comparative sense, comparing to the size of its parent planet, the moon is a rather large moon. And that kind of leads almost like a double planet, mm-hmm. if you will. It's not really technically true that it's quite a double planet, but there is an actual true double planet in our solar system, and that's Pluto with its giant moon Charon. Again, Pluto is smaller as a planet. It's actually physically smaller than our own moon. But when you compare the size of Charon to the size of Pluto, it's even more extreme than our Earth-Moon system. And it now appears that same sort of a giant impact scenario may well have been responsible for forming the moon Charon around Pluto.
Interesting. Now, in this case, Sitchin estimates, based on the texts, that the collision occurred 3.9 billion years ago. Would that be possible?
It's darn close. If you want to consider within factors of a couple, that's pretty darn close, because we're talking about a collision that probably would have occurred very near the Earth's formation time, which was on the order of, you know, we're talking about something like, you know, 4.55 billion years ago. So that's close.
Interesting. All right.
Interesting.
And they also talk about another planet in the solar system on a 3,600 year elliptical orbit. He calls it the orbit of Nibiru, and you know, David, I think I faxed David some time ago the picture of the orbit to see if he could run some numbers and see maybe if they could find this thing, if it's out there. I might want to do the same with you, Dan, and just send it your way and have you take a look at it. But is it possible that there could be a planet in our solar system that is so far out there on its orbit that comes around every 3,600 years? We just don't know about it right now.
Well, in a sense, we're finding objects like that, quote unquote, all the time in the Kuiper Belt, the debris disk, if you will, left over from the formation of the outer planets, Uranus and Neptune and Pluto. Pluto is the largest member of this of the Kuiper Belt out there. There's a component of the Kuiper Belt which many people refer to as the scattered disk. It's the remnants of the objects that came a little closer to the giant planets during their time in the outer solar system than others, and were literally scattered to the very distant regions of the outer solar system. And many of them are objects like Sedna comes to mind, are in fact on these sorts of long looping orbits that have periods of thousands of years. They come no closer to the sun than Pluto. Many of them are actually, their closest point to the sun is even well beyond Pluto, and their farthest distances are maybe 1,000 times farther out. So it's there are objects like that. Some of them are even the largest ones, though, are relatively small from planetary standards. They're maybe, you know, at the largest, maybe the size of Pluto or thereabouts. So we're talking objects, you know, maybe half.
I'll get you a sketch of this orbit and see if you can put it in a computer and see if you can find the planet.
It'd be interesting. Well, like I say, there's a number of objects that have orbital characteristics that sound similar. So certainly, you know, is there a larger planetary Earth size or bigger sort of object on an orbit like that? Perhaps not. I would imagine that there may be objects like Pluto. I wouldn't be surprised if we find another object out there larger than the planet Pluto.
If you looked at this sketch, and let's assume it's accurate, would that help you try to find out where it could be if it's out there?
Well, a lot of these objects, there are biases to the discovery. We've only found a handful of objects like this because, you know, amongst the many hundreds, almost 1,000 now, different Kuiper Belt objects, we've only found a handful, literally, of objects with these sorts of long looping orbits because of the biases against their discovery. They're very far from the sun, so the sunlight reaching them is very faint. And then, of course, the light has to then reflect off of their relatively dark surfaces
sure.
for us to see. So we tend to only find them when they're at their closest points to the Earth. So even a priori knowing what the orbital shape of a
Right, and you'd see that on the sketch.
The odds of actually finding it might be rather small.
Okay, all right. I'm going to get it to you anyway. Who knows?
We'll see.
All right.
I'll hand it on to some of the experts here in our department
parts
of the solar
system. Excellent. Let's talk about asteroids for the rest of this hour, then we'll open up phone calls next hour. As I was doing a little bit of my homework, I noticed that an object just a few days ago called 2005 FN came to about 95,000 miles from the planet. I don't know how big this object was, but that's pretty close in terms of asteroid miles from the planet, isn't it? 95,000 miles.
Oh yeah, anything between here and the moon, passing through our vicinity it's kind of like a cosmic bullet grazing your ear, you know, sort of a thing. It's, you know, at any given moment, there are probably a handful of objects between us and the moon that are the size of, you know, the room you're sitting in. At least once a month, There are objects passing between us and the moon that are maybe the size of the building that you're sitting in, or a little larger. So that's a close distance. Fortunately, those are relatively small objects. I don't know exactly the size of 2005 FN. Given its discovery circumstances, the fact that it was just recently discovered and at that distance makes me guess that it was only seen because it has come this close to the Earth,
right,
which would then lead one to probably guess that it's not very large, maybe in this class of objects the size of a large building.
That would cause damage, though, wouldn't it?
Potentially, yes. I mean, the object of a typical rocky object the size of a large building won't survive intact in its passage through the atmosphere, because coming in from the vacuum of space,
as long as it's not iron, right?
There's even some new research on that that we'll get to. One, I used to be pretty confident in saying that, iron objects though are stronger, and you can, objects like, for instance, the one that created Meteor Crater in Arizona, maybe 40 meters across, are strong enough to make it through the atmosphere. There's a new story on that we can touch on in just a bit. But certainly rocky objects, though, we know from past experience with things like the Tunguska event and other similar almost nuclear bomb-scale detonations in the upper atmosphere, which are caused by the breakup of these rocky objects. When you come in from the vacuum of space, slamming into the dense air of the Earth's atmosphere at speeds of something like, 15, 20, 25 kilometers per second. This is very, very fast speeds. It's kind of like doing what it feels like when you do a belly flop into the pool, right, from a very high thing. For these rocky objects that smack into the atmosphere, the very significant aerodynamic forces that build very rapidly on these objects literally crush them. And as soon as you start to crush it, it creates this sort of a cascading effect of making it even easier to crush the remnant bits. And so, an object the size of a small building will detonate in the upper atmosphere and can create damage for that very reason. It is like the effects of a small or even a relatively modest sized nuclear weapon detonating in the air above you. And
would we hear that explosion?
Oh, absolutely. It's not a fun thing to discuss, but one of the strategies for most effective uses, if you will, of nuclear weapons is not to actually detonate them on the ground itself, but to airburst them above a city rather than in the city. And it's because you spread the air blast effects over a wider area.
Yeah.
And so these rocky objects, even if they're small and don't make it to the surface of the Earth, can potentially cause damage. Now, granted, it's only very local damage, and it's not fun to have the windows in your building blasted out and so on and so forth. From the global perspective, however, it's not all that significant.
How many objects do you think are, splashing into the ocean, and we just don't even know about it?
Oh, yeah, many, many. I mean, we get, every year there are, tens of thousands of tons of material that falls on us from the sky. When you consider something like, three-quarters of the Earth's surface covered by water, by oceans, that's where most of it is going. We detect them by satellites. The Department of Defense has a series of, orbital surveillance satellites, which are put there to detect the infrared signatures of missiles, rockets being launched over the horizon. This tends to be something that one is, wants to be aware of if something is coming over the horizon from another country toward yours. We've invested quite a bit to put these surveillance satellites in place, but because of their infrared detection technologies, they're also able to see the airbursts of these sorts of objects that go off in the upper atmosphere all the time, and these objects are released, these observations of these things are released to a group of people to analyze. And once a month, there's a little Hiroshima going off out there someplace, and many of them happen over the ocean.
In 2029, there's going to be an asteroid that'll get very close. As a matter of fact, originally they said that it was going to hit us, and then they changed their numbers a little bit, but it's still going to get close, isn't it?
Oh, dear, that's a whole story that we could almost spend the whole rest of the hour on. This is the case of 2004 MN4, and back at Christmas time, when the world was rightfully very focused on all of the devastation in Southeast Asia from the tsunami. At almost exactly that same time, and in the couple days preceding that, several of us were aware and conscious of this particular asteroid, which had only recently been discovered, which was showing a fairly and growing significant chance of actually impacting the Earth in 2029. Now, you know, we deal with this all the time. There are, you know, I think we've discussed this in the past, that when you first discover an object out there, you don't have a very long baseline of motion in the sky, motion through the inner solar system near the Earth, from which to, you know, to kind of backtrack its path and to predict in the future its path. So there are great uncertainties into where it's going to go. Those uncertainties change and tend to be reduced over time as you get more and more observations. You get a longer trajectory along which to follow the motion of the object, and it allows you to more precisely predict into the future where it's going to go.
Is it getting closer to us also?
Many of these objects are on relatively Earth-like orbits, which is why we have discovered them relatively easily in the first place. And so they will oftentimes come close to us for a pass and then move away from us again.
All right.
And then come toward us again and do this several times before the ultimate very close approach that we're ultimately often interested in. And this is indeed going to be the case with 2004 MN4. The pass that we're interested in is going to occur on April 13th. In fact, it's Friday the 13th, believe it or not,
great.
Of 2029. Back around Christmas time, you know, we've had these things happen before where the odds grow, you know, okay, maybe there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that it's going to hit us. This cloud of uncertainty in where it's going to pass near the Earth sometimes will include the Earth itself. But the portion in the sky, if you will, out there in space, the size of the Earth relative to that cloud of uncertainty around the Earth is so tiny that, you know, more often than not, you know, 9,999 times out of 10,000, it's going to pass, you know, away from the Earth and not actually strike the Earth. Those are the kinds of odds we're usually dealing with. Back at Christmas time with 2004 MN4.
Not too long ago.
Not too long ago at all, while the world was focused on the tsunami, several of us were watching the odds of impact of this object go from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 100 to...
What?
It got down to numbers almost like 1 in 20.
1 in 20?
1 in 20.
Is it stayed to that now?
No. We now know, thanks again to this process of new observations coming in, that it's not going to hit the Earth. It's going to pass. However, you thought 95,000 miles was pretty close. This object is going to pass so close to us, it's going to pass inside the distance with which our satellite TV satellites are orbiting the Earth.
20-some thousand
miles.
It's
closer to us than our own satellite.
Stay with us. Let's talk a little bit more about this, Dan. And what about the possibilities of the Earth's, and I'm sure it's been factored in, but the Earth's gravitational pull on this thing. We'll be back in a moment.